Okay, thanks very much. I'm going to be talking about work that is recently out with these very fine people. The main goal is to come up with systematic and efficient methods for computing superconformal blocks. So let me start by defining what a superconformal block is. So it's a sum, so it's some function of conformally invariant cross ratios, and it's a sum over all the descendants and superdescendants of some operator. So say we have some primary operator O, superconformal primary operator O. We can get descendants by acting with momentum generators on O, and also combinations of Qs. So in general, if, well, let me just write these combinations. So we have Q, Q bar O, Q squared, Q bar squared O, and then we can have mixtures of Qs and Ps and so on. And it's a sum of the contributions of these states to a four-point function in radial quantization. So let's say we have operators phi 1, 2, 3, and 4. Then we can insert these states in the four-point function in radial quantization. The reason I picked these combination of Qs is that we have some, let's say in an n equals 1 theory, if we have some superconformal primary O that appears in the three-point function with these operators phi, then unless we act with QQ bar, then we'll get some descendant with a different R charge, so it won't also appear in the three-point function. So in general, we just have to pick combinations of Qs that have the same quantum numbers as the superconformal primary. So this is what I mean by a superconformal block. So why do we need to know them? So the main motivation for us is bootstrap applications. In the superconformal bootstrap, if you have a four-point function of operators, you can decompose it into conformal blocks, but that wouldn't be including all the information that you have. The reason is because superconformal symmetry relates the three-point functions of all of these states to each other. In particular, it relates the three-point function of operators that you get by acting with Qs to the three-point function of the superconformal primary. So you need to take that information into account. And taking that into account is equivalent to decomposing the four-point function in superconformal blocks. So to do the superconformal bootstrap, we need some ansatz in terms of superconformal blocks. We need to know what they are. They depend on the supermultiplets. Of the operators involved. So they depend on the external supermultiplets for phi I and also the internal exchanged supermultiplet. They're known in some specific cases. So these include blocks for if you have a combination of chiral and anti-chiral operators in 4D n equals 1 theories. These were computed by just sort of direct computation, basically summing this series. They're also known in some theories with extended supersymmetry. So Balt, for instance, the other day talked about, I guess, for B1 hat multiplets or B0? B1 hat, okay. B1 hat multiplets in 4D n equals 2 theories. And there's similar results for 20 primes in 4D n equals 4. In this case, there are heroic computations by Dolan and Osborne. Which use the Ward identities for superconformal symmetry. Basically, working them out in components and figuring out all the relations that they imply between the four-point functions of operators in these supermultiplets.
Well, yes. Maybe they also did that, but I think the point is that they could use what the trick that Bout explained. That
right. Right. So I was going to get to that. Yeah. So just working out the word identities doesn't give you the blocks. It gives you relations among four-point functions.
But to follow, you know, let's say consider this first example, n equal 1. Okay, what is a set of operators? Phi, it is superfield, or phi, it is lowest component, or what?
Phi is the lowest component. That's
okay. What are other?
That's a good question. So I'll always be taking the external operators to be living in some supermultiplet, and then I'm going to restrict them to the lowest component of that supermultiplet. The reason is because for bootstrap applications, mm-hmm. we want four-point functions of scalars.
Yeah, but is this for phi at the same point, or it's scalar later?
So I'm being schematic here. So what I really mean...
I understand.
What I really mean is a four-point function of chiral, anti-chiral, chiral, anti-chiral, where I do the OPE between pairs like this.
Okay.
And you can classify the operators that can be exchanged in this OPE, and then there's a conformal block for each type, each operator. It turns out there's only one type of operator that can appear. Yeah, you also know it for 5-5. Yeah, that's kind of a trivial case, but yeah. Yeah, you can also do the other channels. The answer is trivial. So the answer for the 5-5 channel is that the superconformal block is just equal to a conformal block. But you need to do some work to show that that's the case. Right, so in this case, the word identities aren't enough. As Leonardo mentioned, you also need a trick, which Bault explained the other day. It has to do with the fact that there's a particular R-symmetry channel in this four-point function where only a single conformal block contributes when you have a single supermultiplet being exchanged. And you can use that information together with the word identities to kind of figure out what all the superconformal blocks are in all the R-symmetry channels. So let's see. And I guess there are also some other examples. There are some blocks known in the 2,0 theory in 6D. This also falls into this category. And some other results that I'm not so familiar with for n equals 8 supersymmetry in 3D, and maybe some other theories of extended supersymmetry. Someone can
yeah, just from a good, I think you can easily generalize this to any half BPS, at not just 20 prime, but
okay.
Every one half BPS and before, and similarly, just all we have R's.
Basically, because you know that, right? So, yeah, using what is now understood about the chiral algebra.
They were also in the older paper.
Ah, okay.
What about 2D?
2D. That's a good question. So in 2D, people haven't been interested in global SL2 blocks for very long. So there weren't actually any results that we knew of for superconformal blocks in 2D that use the global superconformal.
Conformal symmetry is most long in 2D, right?
Right.
So you could
try to write down superconformal blocks for the full supervirasoro symmetry.
Yeah.
You can write down W algebra blocks for your favorite W symmetry. There are lots of different blocks that you can compute in 2D. And I actually don't. I'm not an expert on what's been covered in the literature. Any other questions?
The short answer is because the Virasoro blocks are not known in course four.
Right. Well, yeah. For the sake of bootstrap purposes, we actually know everything we need to know about Virasoro blocks because they're very efficient ways to compute them. Right. And I think. For the sake of the bootstrap, similarly, you'd want to generalize some logic of recursion relations to super Virasoro blocks or whatever other kind of blocks you're interested in.
Basically, I think there's only a tiny handful of papers in 2D doing the same type of recursion relations. Well, you know this too. There are like two or three papers by Bellman trying to write down recursion relations for supervariable zero. And you know, we looked through the literature and that was all we could find.
Yeah.
And they compute the first couple terms in a recursion relation and that's it.
Right. Good. Okay. So so some things are known, but lots of other interesting questions aren't known. So one natural thing that I've been talking about with some people here is to try to look at stress tensor multiplets in n equals 2 theories in 4D. So the conformal blocks for those are not known, but that would be very nice to know because it would be an interesting four-point function to try to bootstrap. Okay, so the general lesson is that we need more systematic and also efficient methods for computing these things. And that's what I'm going to be talking about. So let me start by, and actually we do, so I should mention, we do a number of different things in this paper, but for now, I'm just going to focus on one story, which is the super shadow formalism. Okay, so let me start with the review of the shadow formalism. Which was actually developed in the 70s. And this is probably the most systematic and efficient way we have for computing conformal blocks, just regular conformal blocks. So let's take a look at how it works. So the key idea is to sew together two three-point functions to get the conformal block. So you have some three-point function and you multiply by another three-point function and then integrate them together with some integration kernel. And if you choose this integration kernel correctly, the result will be conformally invariant. So it'll have the form of a bunch of xij's to some powers times a function of conformal cross ratios. So if you can indeed find a kernel with this property, then you pretty much have the conformal block. And the reason is because this thing that you constructed has basically all the properties that the conformal block should have under conformal transformations. So the key example is to consider what happens if we hit this guy with the conformal Casimir acting on two of the points. So if these are the generators of the conformal group, we act with the conformal Casimir on this integral. We're interested in this. So this is equal to some integral dx, dy. And when the conformal Casimir hits this three-point function, because the three-point function is conformally invariant, we can throw the conformal transformations onto this guy. So this actually turns into the conformal Casimir acting on x of this three-point function. Times stuff. And this is just, if O is a primary operator, this just gives some eigenvalue associated with the quantum numbers of O times the same three-point function. So this shows that any expression of this form automatically satisfies an eigenvalue equation for the conformal Casimir. If it is additionally conformally invariant, then that's almost all you need to know that you have a conformal block. There are some slight subtleties, but which I'm happy to answer questions about. But this basically gives you, this basically tells you that G is a conformal block. Okay, so that's the idea of the shadow formalism. And one key step is coming up with what the necessary integration kernel should be in order to make sure that this whole integral is conformally invariant. And in the case of where you just have scalar operators around, it's pretty easy to guess, but let me try to present it in a way that makes it crystal clear why it should be what it is, and also introduces some useful formalism that we'll need later.
And UEV, it's kind of related to this X.
Right. Let me. That's a good question. So let me just define them very quickly. And B is U with 1 and 3 switched. And by Xij, I mean Xi minus Xj. Yeah.
How would I know this kernel exists?
I'm going to construct it right now.
But without explicit construction, that doesn't seem obvious.
That's a good point. So part of the construction is going to be to make it obvious first, and then write it down.
Obviously, the inverse two-point function.
Sure. It's the inverse two-point function. To see that, you need to, you can show that that's true. The non-trivial step is showing that that behaves correctly under inversions, which is not that hard to do. But anyway, I'm going to make it even simpler. So the easiest way to think about conformal invariance is using the embedding space. Some of you may know this construction by some other name, but this is the name that that is most popular nowadays. So the idea is that, so if we have a CFT in D dimensions, then the conformal group is SO D comma 2. Instead of thinking about the usual action of the conformal group on spacetime, which is nonlinear, we want to realize spacetime in a way that where it's really easy to think about the conformal transformations. So this conformal group acts most simply on our d comma 2. The idea with the embedding space is that spacetime. So actually, let me quickly write down the metric. So I'm going to use capital X's for elements of R d comma 2. And my metric is going to be minus x plus x minus. So two light cone coordinates and then flat space. OK. And you can write spacetime as basically the set of points in the embedding space such that x is null. So this brings you from a d plus 2-dimensional space to a d plus 1-dimensional space. And then to get to a d-dimensional space, you can mod out by the relation that x is equivalent to its rescaled self.
So write x squared equals 0.
Sorry, thank you. Good, OK. So all right. So to see very explicitly why this is spacetime, you can use this rescaling symmetry to set any null vector capital X into the form 1 comma little x squared comma x mu in these coordinates. So basically what we've done here is we've taken the null cone By using the rescaling symmetry, I've decided to make all my vectors live on some slice in the null cone. And this is usually called the Poincaré section. And the point is that thinking about spacetime in this way makes the transformation properties under conformal transformations completely obvious. So if I have some conformal transformation, which is an element of SOD, 2, then I can act with it just as matrix multiplication. Generically, this will take me out of the Poincaré slice, so I can use the equivalence under rescaling, just divide by the plus component of this guy to set this back to 1, and then this will equal 1, comma, x prime squared x prime mu. And the map between x and x prime is precisely the usual conformal transformation. So the advantage of this is that the conformal group acts linearly on these capital X variables. And we can lift fields in spacetime to functions of the capital X's in the following way. So if we have some operator phi of dimension delta that's a function of flat space coordinates, then just define capital phi in this way. And one can show that the conformal transformation properties for a primary in flat space precisely imply that that capital phi transforms with just linear transformations on this capital X variable. And you can see that the dimension of little phi becomes the homogeneity of capital phi in capital X. So just as a simple example of what correlators look like in these fields, you can look at a two-point function of these guys. So conformal invariance basically means that everything has to be, well, conformal invariance means everything is SOD, 2 invariant, which means you can only use dot products. And since x1 and x2 are null, this has to be some function of x1 dot x2. And then finally, the homogeneity property for phi fixes this function to be of that form. That's the only thing you can write down. And indeed, there's only one structure for the two-point function that you can have. And if you restrict this to the Poincaré slice, then this is then the thing in the denominator here is equal to little x1 minus x2 squared. So you get that to the minus delta, which is indeed the correct form of a two-point function in flat space. Okay, so that's the embedding space. It's very nice for writing down correlators and making conformal symmetry manifest. And the reason it's nice for the shadow formalism is it makes it very simple to think about what our magic integration kernel should be. So the key thing we need is a notion of integration that is consistent with conformal invariance. So one very natural place to start is, so there's this obvious conformally invariant measure in the embedding space, which is just that, clearly SOD, 2 invariant. If we want to restrict to the null cone, we should add some delta function of x squared. And so then we can try integrating this against any function f. On the null cone. But you can see that, okay, so this combination here, if I take x to lambda x, then this transforms with weight lambda to the d. So this combination only makes sense on the projective null cone if this f transforms with weight lambda to the minus d. And precisely when it makes sense on the projective null cone, we have this object that we can try to integrate. It then has this whole object together has a symmetry under rescaling of x. So to define the integral, we need to divide by the volume of that gauge symmetry. Okay, so this is an integral that we can define, and it's manifestly invariant under SOD, 2. So we usually write absorb all this crap into some measure and write this. So it's infinite. But this is just like any other situation where you have a gauge symmetry. You have to define the integral by the Fadiv pop-up procedure. So you pick some gauge slice, you introduce the correct determinant, and
then you compute the integral. Formal expression, which is made precise on the right.
Good. This is nothing precise. This is just defining notation here. So to actually do this integral precisely, so let me I can do an example actually. Let's look at an integral of something. So the simplest thing we can write down, it has to have the correct homogeneity under rescaling in order to make any sense at all. So let's take some embedding space vector P, and that's pretty much the simplest integral that you can possibly write down. That's actually well defined. So what is this? So this thing is conformally invariant. So to make my life easier, I'm just going to pick P is equal to, I'm just going to use linear transformations to take P to this form times some overall number, so that on the right-hand side, I have 1 over little p to the fourth, 1 over x plus x minus to the d. So this is 1 over all gl1. And let's do the integral over x minus. And we're left with an integral over x mu and x plus. 1 over x plus x mu over x plus to the d. And here you can see very explicitly the rescaling symmetry of the integral. If you rescale x plus, you can also rescale x mu and absorb, and the result will be the same. And so basically to compute this integral, we just have to gauge fix, and a natural choice would be to just say x plus equals 1. So this is actually precisely gauge fixing on the Poincaré section. And if we do that, the Fadiv pop-up determinant is trivial. And so basically what happens is we set x plus equal to 1, and we cancel this integral with volume of GL1. And we end up with an integral, more familiar-looking integral, over flat space, 1 over 1 plus x mu to the d. And this is a perfectly well-defined finite integral that you can then do and get some number. And actually I dropped, let's see, I had my 1 over p to the fourth at front, 1 over p to the fourth at front. So this is equal to some number over p to the fourth. And we can restore the full answer using conformal invariance. The conformally invariant way of writing this is it's just some number over capital P squared. I didn't mean 4. I was assuming D equals 4, but I actually had it as D. And D over 2. Okay? So the actual that goes here depends on how you cancel it with volume of GL1. So you could introduce any constant you want in the definition of the measure. So by canceling them with a factor 1 here, I've defined the integral rigorously. recursely. But so one thing about these conformal integrals is you don't have to do all this rigor to do them. We could have guessed exactly what the answer had to be from the beginning. The reason is because we have this thing, it's conformally invariant, and it has a specific homogeneity in P. It transforms like P to the minus D. So there's only one answer we could possibly write down. There's some number in front of the answer, but the number could be absorbed into the definition of the volume of GL1.
Plus, you start doing several integrals simultaneously, if this ambiguity gets fixed, right?
So,
if you do one integral, yes, but if you do several integrals, then.
Right. So the way to get around that, the way in practice, the only thing we need to do is relate all the integrals we need to do to this one answer. Good. So having done this, it's very clear what we need to do in order to make this integral conformally invariant. So let's lift all these fields to the embedding space. So we just make everything capital. And make these conformally invariant integration measures. And then there's only one thing that we can write down such that this integral makes sense. Remember, in order for a conformal integral to make sense, the integrand had to have this specific homogeneity property. So this thing transforms with minus delta in x. This thing transforms with minus delta in y. We want the whole thing to transform with minus d in x and y. So the only thing we can write here is 1 over x dot y to the d minus delta. It's uniquely fixed. Everything is manifestly conformally invariant because everything is manifestly invariant under rotations, SO decommutative rotations. And so we're done. We're almost done. We just have to compute this integral. Okay. Any questions?
Yeah. Can you remind us what I'm going to do with the so this will give you something which will have the famous shadow.
Yes. Piece. Why don't I leave that till after the talk because I have a lot of ground to cover.
But you said it, there are subtleties that I will be happy to answer.
I'll be happy to talk about them after the talk. Okay. Any other questions? That's not this paper, so that's why I don't want to mention them right. Other questions? Okay. Good.
Do you have primers that are not scalars? Can you generalize?
Yes. So this is something I worked out a couple of years ago. There's a similar story for primaries that aren't scalars. You can also lift them to the embedding space. Slava and Joao and company taught us how to do that. And again, there's a unique kernel you can write down that's consistent with conformal invariance. It looks a lot like a two-point function, but with a funny power. And you insert that and compute. And the nice thing about the shadow formalism, I should say, is that it's quite systematic, and it works no matter what the multiplets of the external operators are. So the
you say when the primaries have higher spin, the kernel is also unique?
Yes. If they transform in an irreducible representation of under the Lorentz group, it's always unique. Okay. Good. So, let's see here. So we're almost to super shadows. But the first thing I should talk about is the 4D case without supersymmetry. So in 4D, the null condition, this can be solved using twisters. So if we have some vector in six dimensions, I can contract it with a 6D sigma matrix. So let me just define this to be XAB, where A and B run from 1 to 4, and M runs from, well, goes over plus, well, runs from 1 to 6. The 6D sigma matrices are antisymmetric in A and B. So this is just the statement that the antisymmetric tensor representation, the antisymmetric tensor of the fundamental representation of SU4 is the vector representation of SO6. Okay, so I can define this XAB. And if this vector is null, then...
But then it's some reality condition, right?
Yeah, so I'm going to be pretty vague about reality conditions for the most part. That's right. So, yeah, for here, yeah, this is the vector representation of SO4, 2 is the antisymmetric tensor of the fundamental of SU2, 2. Okay, so I can, if X is null, I can solve this in terms of twister variables. And this is the usual statement that a plane spanned by two twisters is equivalent to a point in space-time. When I do this, when I make this solution, there is a redundancy under changes of basis for these z1 and 2. So you can see that if I do an SL2 transformation on these indices that I've called A and B, so A and B run over 1 and 2, if I do an SL2 transformation, then this object is invariant, so they correspond to the same x. And actually, we're interested in x only up to rescaling. So I can do a GL2 transformation on these guys, and I get the same x projectively. So what this means is that space-time, so it's equivalent to the projective null cone in R4, 2. And it's also equivalent to twister space. Actually, let me forget about reality conditions. So this is also equivalent to twister space, which is C4, two copies of it, mod by GL2, where the GL2 acts on those two copies of twister space. So this is now complexified. Okay, so this is the claim, and we see it kind of abstractly here, but a very explicit way to see it is to consider what these twister objects are in components. So I have two twisters. A runs over 1 and 2, and it has twister indices that run over 1 to 4. And in components, this is... something with an alpha index, something with an alpha dot index. Yeah. And so we have this. And using the GL2 redundancy, so these are 2x2 matrices. Using the GL2 redundancy, I can set this matrix here to the identity. So transform this into delta A alpha. And what I'm left with is some 2x2 matrix, which I'll call X very suggestively. And this X is the thing that parameterizes the coset space here. And you can see very explicitly that the coset space is parameterized by four bosonic variables. And these are the variables in spacetime. And there's a similar story with twister space as there was with the embedding space. It makes the conformal transformation properties of spacetime really easy to think about. Suppose we have this ZA. If we want to do conformal transformation, then we can act with some matrix, some SU2, 2 matrix. So this is just some 4x4 matrix. When we do that, we'll generically go away from this form, which we'll call the Poincaré section. So we have to then use the equivalence that this is equivalent to MAB, ZB, times some matrix in GL2, some 2x2 matrix in GL2. And this is then equal to the same form with now some X prime. So following this diagram around, the map between X and X prime is the usual conformal transformation. Okay?
Now that you repeat, is there any advantage of using twisters respect to...
Right. So in the case where you don't have supersymmetry, no. They don't help. They just make you confused.
I'm specifically thinking about these cases like in 3D when there are all these degeneracy conditions between tensor structures which you have to keep track of if you work in the usual embedding space. Can you somehow get around these conditions by using this kind of twister-like variable?
Okay, I'm not exactly sure. So I should say that the formalism I found to be most efficient is some mixture of twisters and not twisters. So what I usually in 4D theories, what I prefer to do is keep the space-time coordinates as vectors. And the reason is because there's this GL2 redundancy everywhere. Everything should be invariant under the GL2 redundancy. So it's natural to build objects that are GL2 invariant. And the only objects that are GL2 invariant are these X's. So your correlators are always going to be written in terms of the X's, no matter what.
The little X's. Well,
big X's.
Well, big X's have similar scaling.
That's true. Right. So that's right. That's a good thinking. Yeah, so the big X is SL2 invariant. So then what you need to do is combine big X's in a way that that is invariant under rescaling, and that'll give you full GL2 invariance. So going from the Z's to the X's is a useful first step in writing down any CFT correlator. So it's usually not helpful to think about the Z's. If you have operators of spin, then they have external indices, and for those, it is useful to think about those as being twister indices sometimes.
Don't the normal sets of bar variables have a more natural interpretation in terms of these?
Pardon?
These four 2x2 matrices.
Can you elaborate?
Well, when you express the conformal blocks in terms of Z and Z bar, which gives you a nicer formula, then you can obviously express U and B in terms of Z and Z bar, but that's a quadratic relation. You can get a more simple relation in terms of these 2x2 objects.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, maybe you should tell me about that.
This is very specific for four-dimensional.
Right. That's right. So this trick only works in four dimensions. There are analogous things you can do in three dimensions. Anywhere you have relations between Lie algebras, you can play around with what.
But in 4D, you know, at least we use when you have say p square equals zero, right? Then,
right. So this is different.
It's different type of twister, but it's similar to what you said.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, in general, yeah. In 4D, amplitudes twisters also show up, and there again, the idea is to try to replace the constraints like this with unconstrained variables. I'm just saying in practice and for 4D CFTs, it's usually not helpful to write these guys in terms of these guys. And the correlators are always in terms of these x's. Okay. Good. So so we had these we're gonna be stuck with twister variables though when we go to the supersymmetric case. So let me just talk about some of the things I covered already in twister language. So in twister language, there's also a natural conformal integral that you can write down. In this case, so we have a pair of twisters. So you can just look at the measure d8z. So this is obviously invariant under SU2, 2 rotations, and it has some weight under GL2. So the weight under GL2 is that, so if I take, if I take Z to Z times G, where G is some 2 by 2 matrix, then this thing transforms with a det G to the 8. Okay? So in order to define, in order to write something down that's well defined, I need to integrate against some function of Z with the homogeneity property that F of Z, so I'll write very explicitly, times some matrix is equal to F of Z times det G, sorry. Okay, so if you have some F that satisfies this homogeneity property, you can stick it in here, and you get that the whole integrand is well-defined under this GL2 redundancy. But to define the integral, you need to divide by the volume of the gauge group again. So in practice, what this means is that we gauge fix the integral. A natural gauge fixing to choose is this Poincaré slice gauge fixing. And then it just becomes the usual integral over a flat space. This integral is exactly the one that I already wrote down. So to see that, let's try to write down the simplest possible example of a twister integral. So So I need to write down something with the correct transformation property. So I want ZA, A, ZB, B. And if I put a little epsilon AB here, then this thing transforms with the denominator transforms with a determinant. So I want this to the fourth power. And then I just need to soak up these AB indices. So let me introduce some PAB. PAB is necessarily an antisymmetric tensor in order for this thing to make sense. And via this map, it corresponds to a vector in the embedding space. To do this integral, again, we don't have to go through all this rigmarole. We just have to look and see, okay, we know the integral is conformally invariant. We know what its homogeneity is in P. So the answer is totally fixed. It's some number over P squared squared, where, again, I'm thinking of P as an embedding space vector. This number can be absorbed into the definition of the volume of GL2. So this is exactly equal to the answer that we had for an integral that I called capital D 1 over x dot p to the fourth. Okay, so this is the same thing as before. It's just in the twister variables. Okay. So now we're ready to introduce supersymmetry. So the superconformal group is SU 2, 2/n. So the natural objects that this acts on are super twisters, which have two components that look just like twister components, And then there's some additional fermionic variables. Actually, I'll give these a different name to say that they're fermionic. So alpha and alpha dot are to run over 1 and 2, and I runs from 1 to n. And
everything is in GL2 again.
Right, so I'll introduce the GL2 in a second. So, but this, yeah, this is just a single twister, single super twister, and this group just acts by matrix multiplication on this object. Okay, so to get superspace, what we should do, as Leonardo anticipated, is we should introduce two of these guys. So A also runs from 1 to 2. And then mod out by some GL2 symmetry. So when we do that, we can again fix the top component to be the identity matrix. We get some 2x2 matrix, which I will suggestively call X plus. And then we have some fermionic variables. And we have two n of them. And I'll call those theta. Okay, so we have two n fermionic variables, but we have an object that transforms in a natural way under superconformal symmetry. And the way the transformation works is just by drawing this diagram, but instead using super twisters. Okay, and what these are we'll see shortly. This is precisely chiral superspace. So this is R4/2n. So we don't have the full superspace. We don't have the theta bars. And that's forced upon us because of the number of fermionic variables that we have here.
X plus is not exactly X.
Right, X plus is not exactly X. So let me explain how that works. So let's see. I'm going to have to decide how much. Okay, I'll talk about that really quickly. Okay, so what is the reality condition that defines this group? So there's an inner product, z1 dagger omega z2, where omega, the matrix is following. This group is the group that preserves this inner product. So I'm going to define this combination to be z1 bar. It has an upper supertwister index. So I suppress the supertwisters. Capital A runs from 1 to 4, and then fermionically from 1 to n. And z2 has a lower supertwister index. If we want to have the full superspace, not just chiral superspace, then we need both Z and its bar. So if we have both Z and Z bar, then we get our extra fermionic variables. The theta bars are contained in Z bar. But we're actually overcounting bosonic degrees of freedom. The reason is because there was nothing that said that this couldn't be a complex 2x2 matrix, not necessarily Hermitian. So there are actually 8 bosonic degrees of freedom here, naively. If you just take z and z bar together, there are 8 bosonic degrees of freedom. So you need 4 bosonic constraints And there's a way to impose these constraints that's consistent with conformal symmetry, which is to demand that Z bar A with ZA is 0. And this is four constraints because these auxiliary indices are running over 1 and 2. And if you write out what this equation is on the Poincaré slice, then it gives you the equation that x plus a dot a minus x plus dagger a dot a minus 4i theta bar theta equals 0. And this is solved by setting x plus equal to x plus 2i theta bar theta, where x is real. And so this shows very clearly why x plus is the usual coordinate on chiral superspace. Okay? So to get the actual superspace we want, we need to take z together with z bar and impose this condition. And when we're writing down CFT correlators, CFT correlators are analytic. You can analytically continue them in space-time variables. So usually what we want to think about is not just superspace, but complexified superspace. And the way to complexify is really easy. You just think of z bar and z as being separate, independent variables. But you still want to impose this constraint. So that's the language that I'm going to use for the rest of the talk. Which is not much more time.
Well, one thing we could do is...
Well, I think I actually started like 6 minutes. So let me give you my full 6 minutes, and then we can figure out what to do.
The talk also should be super conformal, right? Invariant on the delay.
Good. That, very good observation. Okay. So, good. So we have our superspace, and in keeping with the theme of the talk, the next thing to do is to write down what superconformal integration is. So what should we do? We should start just trying to write down measures. So the obvious thing to start with is the measure on super twister space. And we have a pair of super twisters, so we need two of these. We have a pair of dual super twisters, so we need another two of these. Okay, but then we also have to impose our constraint. There are four constraints. So we can put in a delta function there. And then we should ask, okay, we want to write down an integrand that makes sense modulo GL2. So what is the GL2 transformation of everything here? So if I act with a 2x2 matrix, so if I go z goes to zg, z bar goes to z bar g bar, so there's a separate GL2 redundancy on each of these independent variables. So this thing transforms like det g to the 4 minus n. This thing goes like, so the 4 minus n is due to the fact that, as usual with fermionic integration, it transforms oppositely from how you would expect, because it's not actually integration, it's differentiation. Here we get g bar. And then this guy, So again, this is a 2x2 matrix, and the determinants are acting on the right and left of this matrix. So so because of the delta function, we just get determinants of those matrices. This thing transforms with det g to the minus 2, det g bar to the minus 2. So that means we need to integrate against some function. That transforms with det g to the n minus 2 det g bar n minus 2. Okay? And if we put all this stuff together, we get something that is invariant under GL2 transformations in both variables. So then we have to divide by the volume of GL2 squared. Okay? And that is super conformally invariant integral. So I should say this thing looks extremely exotic, but on the Poincaré slice, it's nothing exotic at all. So if we gauge fix this integral by moving to the Poincaré slice, then it basically just becomes an integral over x plus, an integral over x minus, integral over all the thetas. The delta function imposes the constraint I wrote over there. And then we just get f of z and z bar restricted to the Poincaré slice. And doing the integral over one of these x's just basically solves this constraint. So this is just an integral over the usual superspace that we would write down naively. But it has to be multiplied by some very specific type of function. And this is one of the advantages of this formalism. We know that f has to have these specific transformation properties. And then we restricted the Poincaré slice. And if we do that, we're going to magically get some integral that is consistent with conformal invariance. That may be not so obvious to check. If you just start out from this integral. So you can try to do it, and it's possible, but messy and ugly. And thinking of it as coming from this more fundamental object is a lot nicer. And crucially for us, this object is actually what you really want to start with if you want to compute the integrals appearing for superconformal blocks. You can compute them using this kind of integral, but it's a giant mess, and you get terms that appear to violate conformal invariance but actually integrate to zero if you integrate by parts in the correct way. It's really tricky. But on the other hand, doing these integrals, you can keep everything manifestly conformally invariant, you don't have to integrate by parts or anything, and life is much easier. So this is a good stopping point, so why don't I stop here? Yes?
So one issue in terms of the general desire to compute superconformal blocks is that in, for instance, n equals 1 supersymmetry, you have superconformal invariants which are nilpotent, just constructed from thetas.
Right.
And so in principle, four-point functions depend not just on u and v, but these extra nilpotent objects, and they even affect the three-point function.
Right.
In terms of your general approach, how would you deal with such things? I mean, they don't occur, I think, if you have chiral externals. I can't remember precisely.
That's right.
But if you have more general superconformal primaries, they are possible.
Right. So if you have nilpotent invariants, then you still have to write down this. You still have to write down this integral. It still makes sense. In practice, what will happen is that the integral over the fermionic variables will be more complicated, and you'll get more terms. So in practice, what we do, and I don't know if this is the most efficient thing to do, but in practice, what we do is we write down this integral, and then we put fermionic variables first, keeping everything in twister language, so not the fermionic variables here. And when you do that, you're left with a series of conformal integrals that you can then evaluate as conformal blocks. So if you have fermionic invariance, then it means that you'll have external thetas that are coupled to these fermionic integration variables, and you just have more work to do. In general, you'll get more terms.
The one way of thinking about these things is that not all the states are determined as descendants of the superconformal primary. And therefore, there's more freedom within the whole framework than you'd like.
Sure. So the way I think of that freedom is it's kind of analogous to when you have operators of spin. You can have multiple tensor structures in the three-point function. Similarly here, the correct way to think about it is to write down your three-point functions in superspace. And then there are just multiple structures that can appear in those three-point functions. Some of them are nilpotent. But the way you define the conformal block is by taking these three-point function structures and integrating them against each other. So if you have multiple, if you have, say, some nilpotent structure that can appear in a three-point function, then there'll be a conformal block corresponding to that nilpotent structure on the left and some other structure on the right and integrating them against each other. So I think it's just analogous to the case of operators with spin.
It is more complicated than just the simple naive extension of the thing you would do for ordinary non-supersymmetric.
I suppose so. I mean, the computation could be complicated.
You know, suppose that you push it through, and at the end of the day, what I'm worried about is that, okay, you'll get the integrals, suppose you do the integrals, you'll get some hypergeometric functions, and then you have to do it spin by spin.
So no, actually, that's a good point that you might worry about that, but in practice we found that you don't have to. You don't have to worry. And it has to do with the fact that the superconformal block is always going to be a finite sum of conformal blocks. So what you can do is you get conformal integrals, but you don't have to work hard doing them because they're just easily related to usual conformal integrals for regular conformal blocks.
Okay.
So actually, let me give you the answer. So we applied this to the case that was already understood of two chiral and two anti-chiral operators. And the block corresponding to this case, when we did the integral, we actually got an even simpler answer than we expected. The conformal integral that popped out was exactly the conformal integral for the following conformal block. So normally in 4D, you can look at the conformal blocks and you can think of having external operators that have different dimensions. And Dolan and Osborne computed the formula for conformal blocks with different external dimensions for us, just in terms of hypergeometric functions. And they also did this very nice resummation in L. And it turns out that the super integral you get is just precisely the integral for this.
What's
N? N is the number of supersymmetries. So this formula is true for N equals 1 and 2. For external chiral operators. And in the N equals 2 case, by chiral operators, I mean the very specific multiplet operators that are killed by all supersymmetries of one chirality. So Balt wrote those as E-type multiplets in his talk.
But we know that this has to be actually equal to the sum of conformal blocks with delta 1 to delta equal 0, right?
So this thing can be rewritten as a sum of positive coefficients times conformal blocks with different dimensions and spins. And these are precisely the conformal multiplets that lie inside the superconformal multiplet gain exchange. And we were expecting to get this answer, but we got something even simpler that we didn't know about.
Do you have any intuition as to why?
No, actually. no, I don't. Well, actually, I should say, we computed this in two different ways in the paper. We also computed it using the So I just lied to you. I do have an intuition of who I am. We also computed it using the super Casimir equation. And the super Casimir equation, the differential operator you get, can be exactly related to the. So that's partial intuition, but that's not. Yeah, that's not real intuition for why supersymmetry corresponds to these shifts in dimensions. So, yeah, I mean, to sum up to what you said, Slava, the conformal integrals you get, you can just write in terms of conformal blocks. In all cases, we get.
A lot of the structure you have here parallels what is done in amplitudes, going back, of course, to the embedding formalism of Dirac and so on, building up. Of course, then you take a different path,
right.
but you're still after superconformal invariant object. So in amplitudes, one approach to go there is to introduce these auxiliary variables, n by k matrices,
mm-hmm.
that you then use to construct manifestly conformal invariant objects, and
right.
you integrate them out, and that ends up giving you an integral in the Grassmannian. So can you get any mileage out of such an approach here?
That's a good question. So in amplitudes, my impression is that usually you're interested in fully chiral superconformal invariants. So you have just super twisters, you don't have the dual super twisters in the amplitude story.
Yeah, but that's mostly focused on n equals 4 because you can get away with it.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And if you're, so you might, well, maybe in n equals 4 you could get away with it too, possibly, because of the self CPT invariance of the spectrum. But that's a different story. And for less supersymmetry, maybe you need both. I think, in fact, maybe that's useful.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, so it, right, so it, in for CFTs, you can never work with all chiral. Just super twisters. You always need the dual super twisters. And for example, if you just want to write down a two-point function, the two-point function of two chiral operators vanishes, and this is equivalent to the fact that there's no invariant you can write down using just the super twisters. So you need the dual
super twisters. I mean, it's clear that you need a different object, but I'm wondering if you can introduce some auxiliary variables to similarly get something that looks like a generating function for super conformal invariants.
Maybe, I don't know.
Should I maybe take a short break, and if people want to stick around, they can stick around, and if people want to go, they can go.
Yeah,
okay.